and a very warm welcome to 20 Minutes With, a podcast brought to you by Proximo, a leading source of news and data for the global project finance, energy, and infrastructure market. My name is Thomas Hopkins, and I am deputy editor of Proximo. I'm delighted to be joined today by Ted Schremp, founder and CEO of IQ Fiber. Ted is going to be discussing some of the work that IQ Fiber has done in the US fiber space, as well as fiber development in the US more broadly. Ted, it's brilliant to have you on the podcast.
Thomas, wonderful. It's wonderful to be here. Good to talk with you again.
Yes, thank you. And I'm sure it's going to be a very, very interesting discussion. Perhaps if I just sort of kick things off immediately, could you tell me a little bit about your professional background? And then indeed, I know some of that involves starting up IQ Fiber. So if you could tell us also a little bit about IQ Fiber and the work the company is currently doing.
Yeah, happy to. I always love, you know, sharing the story of IQ Fiber, and it actually it all does sort of start way back when I was in an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh, you know, business and economics major, and I started working for AT&T half-time during my junior and senior years, and really caught the telecom bug, and have been in telecom for now, I suppose, 30 years it is. Kind of climbing the ranks through a, you know, small mom and pop phone company into Sprint and cable and wireless, doing some things globally. Spent about 6 years at Charter, so one of the key players in the cable industry, and then spent a couple of years in Indonesia, of all places, deploying fiber and broadband in the greater Jakarta area. And so, what's interesting through my whole career, I just had so many different sort of perspectives on the industry. Interesting that I've worked for some of the players that are our key competitors at this point. So things have kind of come full circle to a degree. But I've always been, you know, most interested and most excited about, you know, the creation of capabilities and the building of networks. So, you know, like many folks that are at my stage of career, you know, I've had many, many different experiences, but what I found is that that those that are around building and creating, and in particular building and creating network, have been most interesting. You know, oftentimes people ask me about the couple of years that I spent in Jakarta. You know, it's a developing, you know, Indonesia, of course, is a developing country, but literally everyone on their planet, you know, wants Wi-Fi and wants broadband, which is a little bit of the sort of origin story around IQ Fiber. And that is that, you know, I moved here to Jacksonville, Florida about 5 years ago, and Of course, COVID hit shortly thereafter, and was sitting in my home office, you know, during COVID, working from home and looking out the window and wondering why it is that I didn't have fiber. And of course, you know, frustrated by both the lack of choice in terms of the existing monopolies, and frankly, frustrated by the lack of what I would call a, you know, modern internet infrastructure, which at this point, I think many of us believe to be fiber based. And so, you know, like the creation of many companies, it came from sort of my own sort of personal perception of a gap in the market, and particularly coming out of the private equity work that I had done in Indonesia, you know, began partnering with a number of private equity firms looking at the potential acquisition of a cable company or cable assets or, you know, small telecom and telecom assets as a basis to sort of build fiber on top of. So the original thought was, well, let's buy something that exists today, use that as a bit of a platform to quote unquote edge out from. And so we took a run. This is about three and a half years ago now. Took a run at a couple of potential acquisitions, and fairly quickly came to the conclusion that anything that we would acquire would just sort of be its own project from a kind of repair and renovation perspective, both from a network perspective, a systems perspective, and very importantly, a cultural perspective. And so what we decided to do pretty much 3 years ago, almost to the day, is to start from scratch. And that's what IQ Fiber is. So myself and a co-founder, you know, wrote the business plan, pursued funding in the summer of 2021, and then launched the company late summer 21 and launched the network in late summer of 22. So have found a tremendous amount of success in terms of providing a, you know, modern internet choice to markets that, you know, we believe are underserved. So we're based here in Jacksonville, Florida. Our initial phase one was 60,000 passings here in Jacksonville, competing with AT&T and Comcast. That's essentially complete. We continue to build here in Jacksonville and think there's an opportunity for 100,000 passings or more. Importantly, we about a year ago now, May of last year, announced our first expansion market outside of Jacksonville, which is Gainesville, Florida. It's a college town about an hour and 15 minutes from Jacksonville, so a good sort of satellite market. In that case, the incumbent telco is still AT&T, but on the cable side, it's Cox. So later this month, we will be activating that network and bringing our first customers on, and incredibly excited to bring, you know, choice, competition, and superior technology to that market as well. So at this point, we're building 20, 25 miles of fiber per week. And so very actively constructing network. At the same time, you know, we're far enough into it, particularly here in Jacksonville, to have about 18 months of experience under our belt from a sales, marketing, and operations perspective, and doing very, very well. The market has been very receptive. We're getting sort of credit from a business plan perspective in the form of, you know, very strong penetration, very strong average revenue per customer. And perhaps most importantly, as it relates to the long-term sort of strategic aspect of what we do, and frankly, I would sort of cast this onto the other fiber attackers as well, we just have phenomenal net promoter score with our customers. You know, numbers of, you know, 75, 78 are not unheard of for us on a quarterly basis. And for that matter, some of the other fiber attackers as well, which to me is incredibly important beyond just, you know, penetration and revenue. Of course, you want that, you know, word of mouth. That's an incredibly important part of any new business getting established. And then in turn, we've got, you know, churn numbers that are frankly the lowest I've ever seen in my career. So what that tells me is that, you know, we've got an approach from a technology perspective and from a value prop perspective that is really resonating with consumers. You know, at this point, broadband is really a utility. I think we all firmly believe that it's an element of key infrastructure. You know, you can't live without it. We had a customer tell us in a focus group a couple of weeks back that the number one most important thing in their household was air conditioning, because of course we are in Florida, and number two was Wi-Fi. Which tells you the place that broadband holds in people's lives at this point. And, you know, they've been incredibly frustrated by the lack of choice and competition, the lack of a modern internet alternative. And, you know, that's foundational to our business plan. And that's what allows us to continue to build network at the pace we've been building it.
Thanks very much, Ted. Yes, I can't help but agree in terms of the essential nature of fiber. I think we once had somebody on a Proximo panel at Proximo's Nashville event last year who sort of said that she was aware first of having a Wi-Fi outage, but it actually turned out to be a power outage, but the Wi-Fi was what she noticed first. And I think that sort of reinforced fiber's place in the market. Just sort of obviously you've rolled out fiber from, you know, from Jakarta to Florida and other places, you know, besides. But I, you know, wanted to sort of ask you to sort of set the scene for us a little bit in terms of the US. I know obviously you're quite Florida focused, but I think it'd just be helpful context to know how advanced you sort of feel that the rollout of fiber infrastructure in the US is at present.
Yeah, so my understanding on that sort of macro level for the U.S. as a whole is that we actually did just cross 50% availability, meaning that fiber solutions are available to now the majority, albeit a slight majority of U.S. households. So that's good, and I think maybe most importantly, those numbers are growing quite aggressively each year. You know, having been in the industry for as long as I have, I've, you know, seen all of these sort of technologies sort of come and go, and at some point, you know, what's innovative becomes legacy. And you know, when you just back up and think about it, and this is the way we talk about it with our consumers. I mean, the reality in the U.S. is you have two very legacy networks historically that were adapted for broadband, right? Of course, DSL, which, you know, is in the rearview mirror for many of us, but not all of us, you know, built on copper pairs, right? So the fact that you can get a copper pair to do much of anything, you know, from an internet perspective, in some ways is a technical miracle. But, you know, at this point, clearly DSL style speeds are unacceptable to the majority of the population. But cable's interesting. I mean, I spent 6 years at Charter, so know cable technology quite well and ran marketing for them. So know that angle. And again, sort of a bit of a technological miracle in the sense that you have, you know, an HFC, hybrid fiber coax network that was built initially for one-way analog video distribution. obviously upgraded over time for digital video distribution and two-way digital video distribution, and then ultimately broadband. So the reality is that, you know, fiber has really always been the core of modern telecommunications for the past, you know, 30, 40 years. And the fact that we now have the ability to bring that superior technology literally all the way into people's living rooms. You know, consumers love talking about Wi-Fi because that's the way they, you know, their last sort of stop or last step in the process. But the reality is that we're bringing fiber literally into their living room. And the fact that we're able to do that on a cost-effective basis and do it at a great value and a great price point, I think is a reflection of strong, you know, traction and adoption from a consumer perspective, and then ultimately a business model that works. You know, it's very, very, very focused on execution. Obviously, in some ways, the strategy is easy, but the execution is a different animal. And ultimately, you know, where it comes down to the human in the end, whether a human is our technician in the home or is the consumer that's adopting the service. So what we're doing at IQ Fiber is taking the best technology that money can buy, and, you know, putting the best team behind it to go and really earn it with customers. Whereas, you know, their choices have been severely limited in the past. So I think that's what's driving a lot of this adoption. As much as the technology itself, it's the overall, you know, consumer experience that fiber companies like IQ Fiber are delivering.
Just thinking about the execution, I mean, obviously you've got a background where you spent some time working at Charter, so you know the cable business very well. And, you know, obviously in some cases, as you mentioned, cable remains the incumbent and fiber is a bit more of the insurgent. But to what extent does cable actually remain a significant competitor to fiber in the US? Is this changing at all? I'm just interested in, you know, what that kind of competitive landscape looks like currently.
Yeah, in pretty much all cases for us at IQ Fiber, we are competing with a cable incumbent. As I said, in Jacksonville, it's Comcast. In Gainesville, it's Cox. I think it's probably a little dangerous to think of cable sort of in a full sort of homogenous sense. But the reality is the technology is the same. Generally, the business model's the same. Pricing strategies vary a little bit, et cetera. I think about it is less about the availability of cable internet, and more about sort of the perception of consumers. A lot of this shows up in Net Promoter Score. I witnessed all of this firsthand in my time at Charter, and that is that they are perceived as monopolists, and in many ways behave as monopolists. It's not to say in all cases are they monopolists. I mean, in many cases, they are competing with fiber from the telco, fiber from players like ours, and perhaps they modulate their behavior a little bit. But, you know, ultimately what consumers want is choice and control and a product that works. And so when we started the company, largely, you know, informed by, you know, my industry experience and some others as well, we try to turn the sort of everything about cable that irritates consumers and do the exact opposite. You know, we used to do surveys at Charter where we would say to customers, you know, why did you choose Charter? And the number one answer was, well, I believe I have no other choice. So we focus a lot on the notion of choice, control. You know, we are a what you see is what you get sort of pricing approach. We don't do promotional pricing. We don't do tack-ons for hardware and truck rolls and service calls and, you know, all those sorts of things. You know, we're just trying to provide a really great value and an ultra simplified value prop. And what that does for us is allows us to earn the business away from those incumbent providers. So the way I think about it, just in the most simple terms, is that I'd say half roughly of our value prop is the superiority of fiber. And our goal is to be first fiber wherever we can. And so we get credit for the superiority of fiber. The other, I call it half, of the value prop is all the things that I just mentioned, kind of bringing the humanity back to telecom. You know, the technology is great, but, you know, at the end of the day, there's going to be a technician spending an hour or two in your home to get all of this stuff activated. There's got to be a contact center, you know, that you can get a hold of that, you know, in our case is based right here in the market that we serve. And all of those things, I think, matter to consumers as much as the technology itself. And I think there's an opportunity for innovation around, you know, the rest of the customer experience. I think a lot of times when the large incumbents talk about customer experience, what they really mean is cost reduction and call deflection and automation. You know, what we mean by customer service is, we want to wow you. And that all shows up in Net Promoter Score and churn. And maybe that's the last stop in my response here is the Net Promoter Score piece. You know, it is not unheard of at all for the incumbents to have negative Net Promoter Scores, meaning there are more people, at cocktail parties talking negatively about them than positively. In our case, our Net Promoter Score is, in the mid 70s. And what that says is that, we've got that positive word of mouth. We actually see it in social media all the time, where people are very actively promoting and excited about the experience they've had with us. And that experience is not just the install and, the fact that we brought them choice. We have people responding to our Net Promoter Score surveys that have been with us a year, year and a half, and feel as strongly about the company and the product now as they did then. And to me, that's the strongest foundation for growth that you can possibly ask for.
Yes, indeed. And just thinking about that sort of growth process and, the need to be sort of like a first mover. Obviously, I know part of that process is kind of the planning or permitting phase. And are planning or permitting applications for fiber becoming more streamlined in your view, or do such processes continue to prove a little bit challenging in the context of fiber development? I know there can be multiple sort of authorities you've got to speak to. And I was wondering if this was something that, sort of municipalities or local, local governments, state governments were becoming more familiar with, really.
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag, honestly. I mean, our current markets are all here in Florida. I think lots of people across the U.S., I'm sure across the world, are aware of how rapidly the state of Florida is growing right now. COVID even further accelerated it. So there's lots of development activity of every sort. The construction of buildings and roadways and so forth. And so, fiber as an additional element of infrastructure sort of gets thrown in that same pile of activity, meaning that, municipal governments that are reviewing it from a permitting perspective, and then in turn locates and construction activity, all of this infrastructure work has had an impact, obviously, on municipalities, ability to process permit applications in a timely fashion. And these are very large scale projects. I mean, as I said, we build 20, 25 miles of fiber per week. And we've got dozens of construction crews working. Now, in our case, we're doing that across quite a few municipalities. So we are in the Jacksonville metropolitan area, which is four counties that are all distinct metropolitan areas and a number of beach communities that are also their own distinct government. And then down in Gainesville, we have the city of Gainesville and Alachua County, which again, two different permitting authorities. So what we found is that our number one, developing relationships with those authorities, or at least dialogue, so that they understand the scale and scope and forecast timing of those projects, so that they could, to the extent that their ability, they have an ability to sort of flex up in terms of resources, that they do that. I think, there's nobody that we've talked to in city or local government that's not pro broadband. I mean, how can you not be, right? And we're bringing choice and competition. So even though we may not be the first internet provider to show up, again, competing with cable, they see value for their constituents in having, the superiority of fiber and having competitive choice. So they're supportive of that, but there's just a practical reality that, we knock on their door and start filing, miles and miles and miles of permit, that has an impact. So what we found is sort of spreading our activity across a diversity of permitting authority has been very helpful. If we're backed up in one particular area, which happens from time to time in terms of permitting, we'll put crews in another area. So that sort of flexibility across a footprint, we've found to be important, along with having dialogue with those local authorities. But part of the way I think about it, I mean, today the industry to some degree is fragmented. I mean, there's a number of sort of fiber attackers, across the U.S. that are operating locally. And I think that's probably serves the industry collectively quite well. All things are local when it comes to permitting. And so, us having that local dialogue and those local relationships is really important. And as we evaluate further expansion markets, that's a key ingredient. What we're looking for is not just, the demographics and density and, all those things that you would do for market selection, but also make sure that that we're in a position where we can develop that dialogue locally and get meaningful traction to be successful in the execution of our project.
Thanks, Ted. And just thinking again about just your sort of ambition of being kind of first fiber in a lot of areas, Is there something of a race between fiber developers to target areas with kind of low fiber penetration so as to avoid, what's always talked about in fiber, which is kind of overbuild risk? Is that something you're encountering?
Well, yeah, I guess there's a couple ways to answer it. I mean, on a macro level, there's plenty of opportunity, right? So even if the stats are right and we're just over a majority of households in the U.S. having fiber availability, that means there's still tens of millions of passings, yet to be done. So there is plenty to do. Certainly there's a strong appetite on our part to continue to deploy at the rate that we have been and or accelerate as we go to new markets. And so new market selection is a key part of our business plan, as it is for our, I wouldn't necessarily even call them competitors necessarily, and in some ways their peers or their, just the cohort of fiber attackers that are evaluating markets. I think, ultimately it's not good for anyone to have a whole bunch of fiber competition, because it just erodes your ability to penetrate. And so I think, people do a decent job of competitive signaling, claim a market, and then go get after it. So I think that's but again, there's plenty to go around, so I don't really see it as a key issue, other than, I think we all have visibility to who's operating where. We're based here in Jacksonville, Florida, and as you might imagine, we're going to be interested in markets that are, geographically attractive, relative to home base. And there's plenty of others around the country that are taking similar approaches. And as we, continue to deploy new markets, we'll not just look for the attractive opportunity for us to deploy, but look for, not necessarily contiguous, footprint, but footprint that makes sense relative to the area of the country that we operate in.
And just finally, thinking about financing these fiber projects, which is obviously, an incredibly important part of developing them. In your experience, how viable is kind of non-recourse debt as a financing model for US fiber rollouts at present?
Yeah, I mean, we have an existing, I call it a development facility or construction facility with a series of regional banks. That's been an important tool in our toolkit. We also have a very strong private equity partner with SDC Capital Partners. That's been very supportive of both our current activity as well as our growth ambition, and I think both are important. The analogy I always use with people is, I think it probably, plays globally as well, but certainly a big dynamic right now in Florida. And that is, we see ourselves almost as like an apartment developer, right? Or in just building multiple dwelling units. And we have kind of two businesses, right? One is a development business that's buying land and building a building. And in our case, of course, that's the fiber network. And then we have sales marketing operations, which is, marketing the building, getting tenants in there, making them happy, and making sure they pay rent. Right. And that's sort of the operating side of the business. And, we continue to be in this very fortunate position that that there is value created just in the construction of that building, meaning that, there is inherent value. Certainly you want to lease it up. You want to demonstrate that you picked the right land and you built the right building. And we've done that. But there is inherent value in that building once completed that is in excess of your cost to construct it, right? Some people call it a creation multiple, those sorts of things. So that's an important dynamic, I think, for any investor, is to understand that, yes, you have to be strong from a sales and marketing perspective. You have to prove that you have a real viable business as you scale. But at the end of the day, we are, as an industry, we are building very, very rapidly, and of course are very intentionally cash flow negative as a result. Right, we're building apartment complexes as quickly as we possibly can, making sure that we're doing it in the right neighborhoods and with the ability to lease them up. And so I think that dynamic will continue to serve us both well, both but IQ Fiber as an industry, in that there is very real asset value once that network is constructed. And of course, anybody that's looking for collateral wants strong collateral. And so, it's not limitless necessarily, but I do think it is and will continue to be an important part of the financing structure for companies like IQ Fiber that are deploying at the rate that we are. It is well known, of course, to be a very capital intensive business. That's why we call it infrastructure, I suppose. But it's got that very long term asset value. There literally is, no technology that I'm aware of, that's standing in line behind fiber as being something that's next. In fact, you know, we talk about all the time that, you know, wireless and 5G services, I mean, they're inherently fiber networks as too, right? That all those networks are fueled with fiber. So I think everybody feels very strongly that that fiber is a good generational or multi-generational asset. And so long as that's the case, you know, there will be that inherent kind of collateral value or borrowing base value. And so long as that is there, I think we'll continue to have sources of non-dilutive capital that makes sense for us.
Of course, and I think strong collateral is a good point to end. Because I'm very sorry to say that I think that's all we're going to have time for. But Ted, thanks once again for joining me on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's been great to have you on. Just before we end, I'd just like to take a brief moment to remind listeners about our Proximo Nashville 2024 Digital Infrastructure Americas event, which, as the name suggests, is taking place in Nashville from 21 to 22 May. Further details can be found on our website at proximoinfra.com. Thanks to everyone for listening, and do join us again next month for more of your latest project finance, energy, and infrastructure news and analysis from Proximo.